Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Tony Walsh, good afternoon.
Hello, Brendan. Great to be here.
It's good to have you here. And Tony, people will know you as a journalist and a very well-known and powerful, I would say, LGBTQ plus activist down the years. But you're also, of course, a DJ. And today you've picked five songs for us that bring you back to different times in your life. So your first choice today is Chopin. And it's in memory of your mother. Your mother sounds like an unusual woman for her time. She was a dancer, was she?
Very much so. She studied ballet in London in her late teens. And the only reason she gave it up was she couldn't afford to pay the fees. And this is at a time when her father had died when she was 2 years of age. There just wasn't the money in the family to allow her to continue her studies. So she came back to Dublin and was performing Butlin's Musni in a summer routine, and she met my father there, who was actually playing with a Dublin orchestra called Peter Cusick and his orchestra, a big band, essentially jazz big band. And that's how they met, and they actually did two seasons together and dated before getting married and making a life for themselves. But yes, she would have played the piano when she was younger, but she never continued it. And weirdly enough, I think I came out of her womb fully formed with a taste in both my father's music and my mother's music. And my mother's music would have expanded over all of the Russian romantics like Tchaikovsky and Borodin and Mussorgsky, Rimsky-Korsakov and all of that. But she also loved composers like Chopin, all of the sort of classical orchestral composers, I suppose. And a big draw for romantic music, possibly because she may have been a tad depressive, and I'm not being dismissive of that, but yeah.
Yeah, in terms of what would she, in those days, kind of people would take to the bed now and again or that kind of thing, was it?
No, she didn't take to
just,
the bed.
I mean,
she
was melancholy.
She was, yeah, a little bit melancholic. I mean, when she wasn't a stay-at-home parent, she was working outside of home. In fact, when I was 10, my father had difficulty with work. He was trying to unionise the band that he was in, and he lost his job along with some of his colleagues. I would have been 10, so 1970. And my mother went out to work, which was really unusual in those days.
It sounds like the pair of them, though, your father trying to unionise the band and your mother going back out to work and the dancing and everything, they would have been quite ahead of their time, would they? Was it kind of liberal, activist-y kind of people?
Very liberal. They would have voted for, I suppose, either the Labour Party or the more left-field members of Fine Gael at the time. And remember, Fine Gael, when it was run by Garrett Fitzgerald, and they were part of the Just Society movement. But my dad's family would have been very, very, again, very involved in music. My father and his brothers followed their father into Dungarvan Brass and Reed Band. So music informed the family on both sides.
Okay.
And there was actually a huge amount of culture and a huge amount of... when we were growing up, I mean, politics was grist for the mill at the dinner table, discussion of politics and current affairs and everything.
Okay. So you had no hope from the beginning, yeah. Okay, so we'll take... And I think the second piece of music might be more your father's side of the family. So first, for your mother... this is Lang Lang with the Vienna Philharmonic, Chopin's Piano Concerto No. 2 in F minor, Tony Walsh's first choice this afternoon. Thank you. Now, that stopped us all in our tracks, didn't it? Chopin's Piano Concerto No. 2 in F minor. And I can see what you're saying about your mother and the melancholy, even that kind of minor chords and the beautiful sadness of that. So that was Tony Walsh's first choice today. Okay, so then we get to your dad. I know your dad taught you the trumpet when you were a kid. What kind of kid were you?
Balshy, in a word, but also wanting to be busy doing things. And I was always, I mean, I'm reminded of this by neighbours and some of my younger siblings, that it was always about getting. We lived in a small housing estate in Clonmel when we moved from Dublin in the mid 60s, and we were on the edge of town with this buffered by what was a poorhouse built in 1833 and then became a large psychiatric institution with grounds the size of Belfield in Dublin. I mean, huge, about 150 hectares. They had an abattoir, they had patients out tending fields and stuff, self-sufficient in vegetables. That was our sort of weird playground. But it was very safe. We would walk down country boreens at the age of 9 or 10 and just be left to our own devices and nothing would happen to us. It was really quite lyrical. I look back and I just think, well, I love the topography of Munster and I know you'd agree with me on that. But yeah. It's the thing I still miss, you know, a view of the Cumber Mountains sweeping away, the river plain of the shore. I had a lyrical childhood. I think I feel privileged now as I'm older and make sense of it all. I just feel privileged to have had a loving childhood and even into my teens, where sometimes I did questionable things, where my parents never upbraided me for the life choices I made. There was always that foundational support, and I think that helped me enormously later on when I was wrestling with my sexual orientation and my sense of weirdness.
Yeah, fantastic to have that support from your parents. And even like your dad teaching you the trumpet, that's such it's such a nice thing. And I think it was very good for you as well, was it?
Well, do you know what? He encouraged me to go into Bonacloon Mallet, a youth band that was established when I was 11. So that's 1971. And actually, we had a very erudite Christian brother who I'm really fond of. I'm very cultured, really sweet, very empathetic. I have really fond memories of him. And he was one of the founding members of this youth band. And we had an upright piano at home. So we were encouraged to play the piano. We were classically trained, could read music. And, you know, there's something else, apart from the life skill it gave me to, like, being able to read music, to play it and to actually understand it, like the language, the alternative language that it is. It also gave me access to a great social life in Clonmel in the 70s, in dirt poor Ireland, a bit sort of socially backward and regressive. I always think of the 70s as rather feudalistic in Ireland, very theocratic, the power of the Roman Catholic Church. And the band offered me an outlet for creativity, but an outlet for socialisation. I mean, an example of that is we went to, at the age of 14, we hightailed it to the Netherlands. I'd never been outside the country.
Yeah, yeah.
It's phenomenal, like.
Yeah, fantastic. So your next choice is an old jazz standard, Mood Indigo, and you've chosen Johnny Hodges doing it. What does this bring you back to?
Well, Johnny Hodges played alto sax with Duke Ellington's orchestra and then went solo. And the sax always reminds me of my father. My sax now is tenor sax. His go-to instrument was tenor sax and clarinet, but he also played classical guitar and he played flute. I mean, multi-instrumentalist, he could sight read. So anytime I hear sax, and particularly something that's smoky jazz, it instantly reminds me of my dad. I'm reminded of him actually rehearsing either in his bedroom late afternoon or down in the sitting room for a gig later that evening. And he would have been part of, when we moved to Clonmel, he was part of Mick Delahunty's big band. This would have been a 15, 20-piece band.
Yeah, and they were huge.
Oh, they were massive.
Yeah.
But, like, I mean, the workload was extraordinary. My dad, Vinnie, would be off to Letterkenny one night in a minibus or a small bus, and then the next day, Limerick, and the next day, Cork or whatever, and the next day, Wexford. I mean, it was a crushing schedule. But he was a great musician.
This is a remarkable picture you're painting so far of Ireland and your life and everything else. Okay, so here's Tony Walsh's second choice. This is Johnny Hodges' Mood Indigo. ¶¶ Yeah, we were just saying there's a metaphorical fog of smoke now in the studio. That was Mood Indigo and Johnny Hodges. And indeed, it did really convey a mood, didn't it? That was Tony Walsh's second choice today. So you see, we're tempted to think that the standard story of someone like you, right? You grew up in small town Ireland, and if you're different or, you know, God help us, gay, right? Mm. That your life only begins when you make it up to the metropolis and you find your people and all that kind of thing. So, but clearly you had a very full and rich life before that. But was going up to Dublin and going to UCD, does a different kind of life kick in for you then?
Well, very much it's a different life that kicks in, because you've got, I'm going to a large urban centre where social and political structures are embedded, or were beginning to be embedded. They were coming into play. And you know, a town like Clonmel of 19,000 people just didn't have that at the time. I mean, it's great now. I go back to Clonmel. They have their own Pride Festival and everything. They have structures and they have facilities that enable you to, hopefully, and not always, but hopefully lead a rich and full life without feeling the need to go to a larger urban centre like Belfast or Cork or Dublin.
Okay.
But yes, Dublin was transformative. I mean, I always, even though I was four when I left the city, it felt like I was going back to my hometown. I was able to live in my granny's gaff in Kenilworth Square. My sisters, Louise and Mary, later joined me. One of my first boyfriends also came to live with us. And there were lyrical times. I discovered the Hirschfeld Centre, Dublin's prime LGBT social political spot.
I want to ask you about that. Just before that, is there a coming out at some point? I'm not sure where people stand on this whole notion of people having to kind of come out of the closet anymore. But back then, did there have to be a coming out for you at some point?
Yes, because I understood very quickly. I came out in Amsterdam, actually. I was studying history of art and French in UCD, and then took a summer job in Amsterdam and came out there because they had a flourishing gay scene. I knew I was gay from the age of nine. I just didn't have a label for it, because I certainly didn't see any evidence of that label in Irish society. But I very quickly understood back in 1979 that it was coming out was a very necessary and important political statement. A political statement to me, for me, a political statement to the world at large.
That I am not ashamed.
All of that. And also to signal representation at a time when there were scant positive images in print and broadcast media, certainly not on TV, very few on radio.
Kind of invisible.
Invisible. I have to say too, though, that people come in, think that coming out is one big dramatic moment where you just push open the door like Diana Ross and go, I'm here. But, yeah. You know, it can be a sort of creeping process. You know, in fact, for me, how I came out was I got involved politically. I always thought that just everyone knew I was a screaming gay. And I didn't care. Well, not too much. I mean, I was a bit of a sort of weird boho teenager in Clonmel, you know, wearing floppy hats and trench coats or whatever, and sort of reading gay, you know. But I remember writing a letter to my mother in 1980, so it would have been 19, telling her that I was going on an international gay conference to Belgium. And that was really me sort of emphatically signalling that I was gay and I was involved in this group.
Yeah.
And then
her jaw didn't exactly drop, I'd say, did it?
Well, no, because her stepfather had been either bisexual or gay and had also developed a career as a drag queen in the late 50s and 60s.
Okay.
In England. My grandmother had remarried and she met a guy doing repertory, that sort of theatre, small little pop-up theatres around the country. And she married this guy, had three children with him, and then divorced him later on. But so, yes, there would have been, you know, my parents were definitely not uncultured, and they weren't unaware of what was happening in the world. And they were also, too, like, they really were. I really feel lucky. Just, I mean, talking to you, I realise how lucky I was, because they were rarely judgmental. And actually, I remember my mother upbraiding me one day. I just sort of was gossiping about some neighbours to her, and she said, don't ever talk about other people and don't ever judge other people's relationships unless you're in it. You don't know what's going on. And she hated that type of sort of petty, malicious, small talk, and would have actually censored us for actually accommodating it.
Yeah, you were very lucky, really. And I know we all know that not everybody has as kind of fortunate a story from those times. Now, so you mentioned the Hirschfeld Centre, and I think your next song brings us back there. So tell us about the Hirschfeld Centre, and tell us about Fern Kinney and Together We Are Beautiful.
So I remember walking into the Hirschfeld Centre in September 1979. I was sun-kissed. There'd been a heat wave all over Europe, and the building was about 6 months old. I'd answered a personal ad in a magazine, in Dublin Magazine, and this guy my own age, 19, from Temple Oak, suggested we go down there. And I remember walking in and going, oh my God, this is a revelation, an absolute revelation. And it was like a multifunctional community centre. It would have been a second attempt at a community centre in Ireland. It had a women's group, a youth group, a cinema club, a library, a cafe, offices, and a dance club. And I just wanted to get on that dance floor and sort of exuberantly shared any last vestiges of oppression that I felt.
Okay.
And I remember, the reason I've chosen Fern Kinney, Brendan, because I remember, it's really seared into my memory. I remember watching a slow set on the dance floor. And it was my first time watching lesbians and gay men dancing to a slow set. I mean, in some ways, it had the vibe of a parish hop, which I'd sort of experienced in the 70s in Clonmel.
Yeah.
But there was something really revelatory and transformative and transgressive about seeing same-sex couples dancing together and experiencing and exploring all of the sort of intimacy and desire that their heterosexual counterparts have take for granted at any age. You know, it was like learning. You know, you have to sort of learn something like that in terms of physicality. For lesbians and gay men, we have to learn. We have to unlearn all of the shame and stigma that we've been grown up with. Well, certainly my generation had to. And then sort of learn this new language of feeling comfortable with other people and expressing our desires and negotiating intimacy. And the slow set was the perfect example of that. It really was just, it was something spectacular. Showing that type of intimacy was criminal. Men holding hands or kissing in public or in private was a criminal act under old Victorian British legislation. You could get 2 years in prison. The law that sent Oscar Wilde to prison. So, you know, we had to seek out these special places to engage in any form of intimacy like that.
OK, let's take you back, so, to the Hirschfeld Centre. This is Tony Walsh's third choice. This is Fern Kinney, and Together We Are Beautiful. Fern Kinney, Together We Are Beautiful, and that's Tony Walsh's third choice today. And this, if nothing else, this is a fantastic musical education For me, that's a terrific song. So your next song is Barbra Streisand, The Love Inside. And we talked there about the joy of the Hirschfeld Centre and everything. And then this is another side to the story of your community in Ireland and everywhere. I think this song brings you back to the early days of the AIDS epidemic, does it?
Absolutely. I mean, well, I've overlaid it. I've since overlaid it. I mean, Barbra Streisand, The Love Inside from Barbra Streisand's Guilty album that was produced by Barry Gibb is an immaculate album of there's some choice tunes on it, ballads and sort of more mid-tempo stuff. And it was also came out in 1980, so it would have been a go-to, one of my go-to favourites for those sort of moments of indulgent melancholia.
Yeah. Nothing like it, is there? Yeah.
So it seemed, yeah, and because of that, it seemed like the perfect, Love Inside seemed like the perfect epitaph for to be played at wakes and friends of mine who died of AIDS complications with increasing regularity as the 80s wore on. And you know what? We prepared ourselves as best we can in Ireland at a time when condoms were only partially legal, when there was no non-judgmental sexual health education. There was a paucity of clinics. The first STI clinic was only founded in 1987 by Fiona Mulcahy in James's Hospital in Dublin. So there were difficult times. I mean, there were difficult times for all of us, but they were particularly different times for disadvantaged communities like LGBT people, and also like inner city drug injecting communities were disproportionately impacted by the AIDS pandemic. And we were, in a way, we were left to our own devices. There
really?
Was a spectacular dereliction of duty by the state at the time, which I have to say made me angry for a long, long time. And I think I only managed to pause my anger when Taoiseach Leo Varadkar unveiled the National HIV AIDS Memorial in Phoenix Park a couple of years ago. But I've chosen this song because it helps me keep alive the memory of cherished friends, and It's a key to unlocking the place I found myself in, mourning people, going to funerals, sometimes not going to funerals because I just couldn't bring myself to go to yet another funeral. And I do remember it specifically being played at the after's party of a friend of mine who was my own age when he died. I think it was my friend Barry would have been... I knew people who died of AIDS complications before Barry, but Barry was the first person of my own age who I had a very direct connection with, and we were both 27, and it floored me, absolutely floored me.
I can imagine. Just before we get to the song, so in 2005, you is came out as HIV positive, the phrase I'd use, yeah.
I was diagnosed HIV positive in 2005. And then I didn't care who knew. I very quickly just got that information out because I just thought I want to own this story. And this is still at a time where there was an enormous amount of lingering stigma and shame, much more than there is now. But I, 10 years later, in 2015, after my mother died, I was ready to talk about how I had become HIV positive. And I also felt at that point, it was necessary, again, it was like another form of coming out. It was necessary to put a face on it. And back in 2015, there were still only a few people who was Ireland's famous drag queen, Panty Bliss, Rory O'Neill, who was very vocal and visible. But there were very few other people. There were no women, for example. There were no immigrants. The voices, there wasn't a multiplicity of voices representative of the demographics impacted by HIV and AIDS. And I felt I had to do something about that. So I just put up a little manifesto on Facebook and social media. And that was just to sort of normalise and go, OK, let's, you know. And also because I think having survived the pandemic, I had to exercise a lot of guilt. This is really weird.
It's the survivor's guilt, yeah?
The survivor's guilt, yeah. I mean, it sounds self-indulgent even talking about it, but it is a thing, you know, having survived when so many people died and then wondered, why did I survive? And then to become HIV positive at a time when you just take a pill and you get on with your life.
Mm. You know? And the circumstances of how you contracted HIV that you didn't talk about until after your mother died?
Well, no, because I was raped and I just thought that would have been too much of a big deal for her. She knew I was HIV positive, but in my own head, I don't think she would have judged me, but she wasn't in a place. You know, she was ill. She had her own issues to deal with, health issues to deal with. And I didn't want to burden her with... I'm not afraid to talk about it. And I think it's actually, right now, I think it's really necessary.
Why is it important to talk about that aspect of it, Tony?
Well, I've often thought gay men, we haven't had, as a community, we haven't had our Me Too moment in terms of, you know, opening up conversations around consent and bodily integrity. I mean, we talk about it in the context, Brendan, we talk about it in the context of sexual health and avoiding STIs.
Okay.
But when it comes to negotiating desire and intimacy, I still think there's a lot to be done in educating ourselves both within our community and on our own terms, but also more widely, you know, in sort of wider Irish sexual health education. We need to develop a more, I suppose you'd call it, a more holistic attitude to how we negotiate desire and intimacy.
That people feel comfortable. Is there a sense that people don't want to talk about it in the gay community because it's letting the side down or something? There's a disloyalty there?
No, I don't think it's that at all. But, you know, historically, men, gay or heterosexual, have always been reluctant to talk about sexual abuse or rape because it feels akin to some form of emasculation, you know?
Okay.
Only women get raped, you know? And the other thing too is, like, for a long time, gay and bisexual men and lesbians have had to perfect an image of ourselves for presentation to a wider society to say, listen, can we pass? Will you accept us? In terms
what,
of
be kind of cuddly and unthreatening.
Well, yes, and I think there was a part of that. Even for the marriage equality campaign, we had to dampen down some aspects of the way we negotiate desire and intimacy. We couldn't talk about polyamory. We couldn't talk about alternative relationships. You know, we had to just simply talk about.
We're just like E, and we want
to. And now give us a chance to do it. You know, does that make sense?
Like? Yeah, it makes absolute sense. That's really interesting. I've never heard that before.
And
so you would have been full square behind gay marriage and everything, but at the same time, it wasn't the full story. Is that
well,
it?
Look, if anyone wants to get married, fine, great, go and do it. But I also think too, we have to acknowledge that there are, in society, there are, and in the context of human desires, heterosexual and homosexual, there are a multiplicity of relationships, domestic relationships, lover relationships, whatever, with or without formal registration. So I think that, and now in a sort of post-mar ref, we're 10 years on, I think maybe now we're grown up enough to acknowledge that multiplicity of alternative relationships.
Okay. Listen, we nearly forgot to get to the song. So here's Barbra Streisand, The Love Inside. This is Tony Walsh's Fourth Choice.
And we both played along. Love is easy on the young. Life was together. As the world fades away into yesterday, I'm losing you forever. I'm just an empty shell with nothing for tomorrow. I'm here to face the sorrow. The dream we sailed was far and wide. You loving me.
Okay, that's Barbra Streisand, The Love Inside, and that is the fourth music choice today of journalist, DJ and LGBTQ plus activist Tony Walsh. And Tony, time's against us now, so I'm going to jump straight to your final choice. Tell us about Viola Wills. You ended up becoming friends with her.
Viola Wills was a soul disco singer raised in LA, had five children by the time she was 25, left them with her mother and then skedaddled to the UK. She'd been a backing singer for Joe Cocker and Barry White and then rocked up to London in the 70s and ended up remixing a well-known tune called Gonna Get Along Without You Now, and then had a slew of disco hits. And I decided to bring her over to the Flickers in the Hirschfeld Centre in 87.
Right, yeah. And she came.
Well, actually, I found the phone number of her manager on the back of an album, phoned him in LA, and he said, oh, Viola lives just down the road. I'll give you her landline, as you do in 1987. And then I rang her, and that was the beginning of a terrific relationship. She came over, she did some gigs. We stayed in contact. She came back again. Her last appearance was in the George in Dublin in 2003. And in the intervening period, when I was living in London, we hung out in London. She performed in Ronnie Scott's, the famous jazz venue. I still remember a raucous night we had on the tiles in London. And she would have been a few years younger than my mother. She would have been born in the late 40s.
Right.
But she was a gorgeous, sassy black woman. Lovely.
Okay, another chapter in what has been so far an extraordinary life, and you tell it so well and so interestingly. Tony Walsh, thank you so much. We'll finish now on your final music choice. This is Viola Wills and this is Dare to Dream.
It's only on the road we see till we stop believing and fly and be as one.
RTE.ie.